You are listening to New Church Core Beliefs for Teens. This podcast is with the Reverend Scott Frazier on the topic of who is God. Mr. Frazier, if you could just start off by giving us a quick New Church general overview of who God is, that would be great.
Sure. The trick to trying to describe God is when we want to think of what God is, what the divine is, who he is, you don't want to limit him. But the moment we start describing the divine, we naturally start limiting him because we have, you know, finite brains. So if you say, well, he wants this or he does that or he is that, you've already sort of gone off the rails because he's infinite. So any human speech we use to describe God is going to be inappropriately limiting. But we have no other option. So we have to find a way to describe God. And one of the ways we describe God in the Swedenborgian faith is by starting with a series of adjectives. And it's sort of a priority system. You think of him sort of in this order. You don't have to, but this is a way to properly put all the pieces, so to speak, of the divine, of God, in place. So the first thing you can say about God is that God is. I know this sounds very obvious and basic, but it's the least limiting thing you can say about God. If you think about the Old Testament and when Moses is going to the burning bush and he meets God for the first time and they're talking and Moses says, well, they're going to want to know who you are. Who do I say that you are? And what God says is, I am that I am. You know, the I am thing in the Old Testament. And that is this most basic statement. God is. That's the first reality. And in a sense, we are because he is. He is the prime mover. He is, in Latin, the esse in existere. He's the isness. He's the is from which all other things are. So that's our first statement about God or the divine, is. And you'll note we don't have any person, we don't have any intention involved, just is. God is. So that's the first thing. And of course, at this point, people already disagree because some people think God is not. But we think God is. So there's our first statement. The second statement is that God is one. God is not three. God is not 17. God is not 87,000. God is one. And we can go into the philosophic background of this, but if there's going to be an infinite, if there's going to be a divine, if there's going to be a God, there can be just the one of them. Because if you have two gods, well, who's really God? You know, does one listen to the other? If they have an argument, who wins? Or if you've got, say, two or three or five gods, but they never disagree, and they never do anything differently, and you can't tell them apart, then guess what? That's one God. So God is, and God is one. Those are the first two things through our little exploration of God. And then the next one is a little surprising. God is human. Now, human, sure, in the sense of 10 fingers, 10 toes, eyebrows, the rest, but that's not the essence of being human. What the heavenly doctrines say is that the essence of being human is that we have, because we're the first example we have of being human, is that we have a will and an intellect, or to put it more basically, we want and we think. Because we can want and think, we can do. And we are just copies of the actual human. It's kind of an odd thought to think that you're just a copy, but we are copies. And in Genesis, it says that man is made in the image and likeness of God. People are copies of the human God. So God is one, and God is human. And by that we mean he wants and he thinks, and therefore he does. Now, we can talk lots more about all the implications, but these are our first three sort of adjectives or qualifying words to describe the divine, God, godness, whoever's up there, the big man. And then there's one sort of wrapping that we've got to put around it, and that is that God is one human who loves. And this is really important. This is extremely important to Swedenborgians. God is not fickle. God is not distant. God is not cold. He is a person who loves. In the sense that he wants. But he doesn't just want, like we might want a cheesesteak or more time off or whatever else. He loves. And one of the nice things about Swedenborgian theology is when you bring up questions like, well, what is truth or what is love? It's not a rhetorical question. We have answers, usually multiple answers. So consider love in the following three ways. Love has three prerequisites before something can be love. It needs to love something outside of itself. So you can't really love yourself, because that's not really love. You have to wish to be closer to that which you love. Like if you love somebody, you want to be with them more, be geographically closer to them, be more like them, that kind of stuff. And the third thing that acts as a qualifier to whether something is love or not is you want to make that other happy. So love requires outside yourself, you want to be closer to it, and you want to make it happy. And so the divine, God, is one human who loves, who wishes to make others happy. And that is the basic understanding, the conception, if you will, of what God, of what the divine is. And we haven't hit the New Testament, we haven't hit anything about heaven, we haven't hit any questions about how life works, but that is our basic, fundamental starting position. And when I say basic, fundamental, and starting, I mean that. Basic in the sense of those are the ideas that are easily understood without other ideas. It's fundamental in that it acts as sort of the foundation or the place upon which we build other ideas. And it's the starting point because if we're going to talk about this in terms of explaining through time, we have to start there. So, God is one, and God is human or person. And this means that he loves. So that's the basic answer. From there, we can take it into a bunch of different directions.
So you said God is one. So what is God like in terms of the Trinity?
The Trinity is a tricky word because it doesn't show up in the New Testament, partly because it's an English word and the New Testament's written in Greek, but also the idea of a Trinity, that word doesn't really show up in the New Testament. And so when you read the Gospels, it does seem that there's a Father and a Son and a Holy Spirit. And everybody in Christianity agrees on this. The question is, so how do they all fit together? Swedenborgian point of view is that they are not different people. And we can fight about the Latin word persona and hypostasis and all that stuff, but that doesn't really matter. There's got to be one person who's God. And so if you're thinking of the Trinity, well, so how does that work out? An effective way of figuring out how God works, this is a little tricky, is to think, well, how do people work? Because remember, we're copies of God. So if we can understand how we work, it might give us a little insight into how God works. Obviously, you can take that too far. So we have a Father, a Son, and a Holy Spirit. We have the wanting part. That's actually the Father. Divine love, divine essence, divineness. The is, if you will. We have the Son, and this is the person of Jesus Christ, who is God. I'm going to talk about Jehovah in a second. And that's sort of the divine human part, the divine oneness, the divine shape, the divine form, and the divine truth. So you've got the divine love and the divine truth, or divine wisdom. And then you've got the Holy Spirit. And everyone always kind of scratches their head, so what's for the Holy Spirit? Because, I mean, is that like a ghost, or... It is merely the expression that the divine has an effect on the world around it. Just like you do. I mean, you go through life, you know, you do your stuff, you affect the people around you. You want, you think, you do. That's a little copy of the Trinity. And God divinely wants, that's divine love, that's the Father. God divinely thinks, that's divine wisdom, that's the Son. And God divinely does, that's divine action, that's the Holy Spirit. And they're not different people. That's very, very important to Swedenborgian theology. They don't have disagreements. There's no situation where the Father wants one thing and the Son wants another. No, any more than you can have within yourself, well, I want this, but I think that. We have that appearance, but you're one person. There aren't multiple yous running around inside your head. If there are, then you should probably seek some professional attention. To think of God as having arguments with himself is a little odd. Now, we can go round and round these terms and these words a little bit. So let me offer this sort of clarifying question as to whether you think God is one person and how you view Jesus Christ and the whole gospel thing. I believe, me, Scott Frazier, believes that Jehovah is Jesus Christ. That view falls outside of a lot of Christianity. And I don't want to describe any particular person's belief, but there is this idea out there that you've got sort of an angry father guy, and he's got a law code he insists on following. And then you've got the loving Jesus guy, and he wants everybody to be saved, and they cut some sort of a deal. And you got to know about the deal. Swedenborgian theology says that is not what happened. Jehovah is Jesus, which completely recasts the importance of his life and crucifixion while on earth.
So God is seen as, to most people, as perfect. Is that a good way to look at him?
Ah, perfect. Yeah, that's a little tricky, because perfect can go a few different ways. First of all, I don't want to ever get trapped into saying that God's not perfect. But how we conceive of perfect can be a false notion, and if we insist that God fits into that false notion, then you're going to have problems. For example, if you think he's flawless, what does that mean to you? Does he ever disagree with you? Because if he always agrees with you, could I suggest he's not perfect, because neither are you? But we tend to see things that agree with us as the right way to go. Perfect also can mean done. We don't usually mean this when we say perfect, but to perfect something means to complete it. And God is certainly complete in a way that we're not. But sort of viewed more colloquially, does God make mistakes, or does he lose his patience, or does he wish something else would happen than did? Those are different things. First of all, as to whether he loses his patience, the answer is no. God is human, and we think of him as a person, but that doesn't mean we think of him with all the flaws that us copies have. He's the one without the flaws in the copy. So he doesn't lose his patience. He doesn't do something and then wish he hadn't. He doesn't get angry, which is a little bit of a shock if you read anything in the Old Testament, or even the New Testament, where there seems to be a lot of anger. He is love incarnate. He is the essence of love, and in that way he's unchanging. So if perfect to you means doesn't make mistakes and doesn't give in to anger or hatred, then yes, God is absolutely perfect. But if you think that everything that happens is exactly what God wants to happen, well, that's different. Because it's very, very important that we know that what God guards more than anything else is our freedom. Goes back to those rules of love. Got to love something outside yourself, you got to want to be close to it, and you've got to want to make it happy. That doesn't work if the person you're trying to love isn't really a person, has no freedom, is more of a robot. And so we live in a universe where God knows what he wants, and he hopes we get it, and he hopes we do it, but we don't have to. So we can fall into the mistake of thinking that God's not perfect because we see lots of imperfection in the world around us. Everything from, a hangnail to world wars. But that gap between the infinite, the perfect, if you will, and what we see is not only allowable, it's essential for us to be something other than God, for God to love. But when you think of God being perfect, does that make him easier to relate to or harder to relate to? Because if it makes him harder to relate to, then maybe it's not an idea to really latch on to too strongly. But if it makes him easier to relate to for you, well, then by all means. Sometimes, though, we get tricked into thinking that, well, if someone has no flaws, then they're hard to really understand, or they're not like me. Well, that doesn't make him two-dimensional or implausible, like a book character. Just think of someone who always, always wants what's best for you, cherishes your freedom more than anything else, and knows everything. Would you call that person perfect? Because that sounds pretty awesome to me.
So if God doesn't have all the flaws that human has, does he understand them? Like, can he comprehend them?
Oh, that's a great question. And sort of broader, how does the infinite even reach the finite? How does the infinite touch the finite? How can God understand us at all? Because, well, we have a hard enough time understanding him. Can he go the other way? There's sort of a broad answer to that and a more specific answer to that. The broad answer to that is someone who's omniscient also knows everyone's flaws. And if you think about it, you don't necessarily need to have flaws in order to understand them. You can see something as it's supposed to be, and you will know what it would look like were it to have a flaw. For example, when you watch a television show on a widescreen TV. Now, this is not perfection, but bear with me. You can, with the imagination, imagine what it would be to see half the screen. You don't need to break your TV, as I had happen when one of my children threw a little metal car at the TV screen, you don't need to have part of the screen disappear in order to imagine what that would be like. And as an omniscient being, neither does the Lord. But there's a more specific answer. One of the things he did when he came on Earth, you know, New Testament, Jesus Christ, is he took on what we call hereditary evil. Now, this sounds weird to say that God took on evil, but here's how this works. He inherited stuff from Mary, right? Mary is his mother, and God is his father. Isn't that him? We could go there. But so he's got both inside him. And through his life, he had all those inclinations to do bad stuff that we all do. Now, inclinations are different than actually committing it. But we've all had the inclination to lie or to steal or to lose our temper. That doesn't mean we gave in to it, although I'm sure we all have. But you can feel that. Oh, but if I told a lie, everything would be so much easier right now. And while on Earth, Jesus Christ had that same inclination. Now, what makes him different is that he never, ever, ever gave in to any of them. And so throughout his life, he sort of starved or killed off all those inclinations in himself. But he did have them. And it is through that heredity that gave him, in a sense, access to those states of evil which we all wrestle with. So that when we wrestle with, oh, it'd be so easy to tell a lie right now, and you need a little help, part of how he helps you is because it is a state that he has had. The difference being, he never gave in to it. So you can say he's perfect, and he's been there. Needless to say, this gets much more complicated, and to my mind, much more fascinating. But the basic answer is, he took on a hereditary evil from his mom, which allowed him access to those evil inclinations. So yes, he knows exactly what you're going through. And it's sort of an addendum to that. When you're reading the Old and New Testament, there's some really unpleasant stuff in there. If you ever want to get like really depressed, go read the Book of Lamentations. It's nothing but a giant series of complaints about horrible, horrible things. And you read it and you're like, why is this in the Word? How is this God speaking to me? And part of the answer is that the Lord can speak to any state we have. Our happiest states, our saddest states, our angriest states. It's all in there. And when you're in a terrible, sad place, yes, the Lord can even reach you there. Part of his word speaks to that state because he knows it. He knows it better than you do. So absolutely. Perfect though he may be, he's been where you are and he took better notes.
So, for as human, does God feel like emotionally?
Ah, feeling. I can think of the current students I'm dealing with where feel, they all know, is a very tricky word. Now, feel... oh, so much stuff. English, you notice how English doesn't have rules, right? Words sort of mean what the loudest person says they mean. And so the English word feel means a lot of different things, and people play pretty fast and loose with it. Feel can mean I sense. Like if somebody pinches you, you feel that. You've got a sensory phenomenon. Ow! You can say feel as in an emotion. I feel angry. I feel happy. I feel full. I feel hungry. You know, it bleeds into sensation and emotion. But, you know, I feel emotions. That's very different than the pinch. But we also have a way of saying feel as sort of almost code for think. For example, were I to look out the window and say, I feel it's dark out there. That's kind of the thing people say these days, but that's not fair. You feel emotions. You think thoughts. And if I leaned out the window and I said, I feel it's bright orange outside. You'd all look around and say, but it's not bright orange. But you see, I'm playing a little trick because you can't tell someone their feelings are wrong. That's just not how we talk. So people sometimes say feel when they actually mean think. And that's all just a sidebar. The idea of emotions, you know, can he feel sad? Can he be upset about things? Does he feel disappointed? Things like that. And the answer is yes. God is one. God is one human or person. And can you imagine a person who doesn't feel? I mean, that's a robot. That's not really a person. Now be careful about which emotions you attribute to him. Let's start with happy. God can feel happy. It would be very weird if we imagined God never being happy, just, you know, straight-faced the whole time. And now I'm doing this. And now I'm doing this. And that's not a person. Furthermore, we feel happy. Happiness is that thing we seek more than anything else. And if we seek it, and we're just copies. He seeks it too. That's what he wants. So in terms of, you know, positive emotions, absolutely. Now, the negative emotions are a little trickier. Because anger, we know for sure, God is never angry. Because anger is the desire to hurt somebody, you know? I mean, one of the physical signs of anger is a bald fist. Right? God does not feel anger. He's never choking down his anger. He's never a little angry but hiding it. It's just not there. That makes him a little harder to picture as a person. What kind of person never loses their temper? What kind of person never comes close? And yet, that's what we hear about him. Then there's sort of a gray area, like disappointment. Can he feel disappointed? Well, in the New Testament, we read that he weeps, he laughs, he even speaks sharply to people. So something like disappointment, I think he does. But not in the sense of being surprised. Like, if it's Christmas time and you think that you're going to be getting an Xbox Kinect and you see a box under the tree and it looks like the right size box, right? And you go and it's your turn to open the present, you open it up, and it's 5 sweaters packed very tightly. You're disappointed, right? I don't think that's the kind of disappointment that God deals with. If you think of disappointment being a surprise, oh, that's not what I wanted to happen. I thought something else would happen. I don't think that happens to God. But now, I'm a parent, so there's a different kind of disappointment that parents see all the time. Where you see a kid, like, you know, take a 5-year-old doing something that is making them unhappy. And you can't convince them not to. You ever see this? Sometimes teenagers do this too, I hear tell. And so the feeling you have when you see someone else doing something that just makes them unhappy is disappointment. You're not surprised. You know exactly how this ends. You feel, what would you call that? That's disappointment. Oh, I wish you weren't like this, but I know you are. Oh, well. And I imagine a lot of the time when the Lord sees us engaging in evil and drinking down misery, I think that's the emotion he has. Sort of a, okay, I'll see what we can do with this. But absolutely, he's a feeling person. In fact, he feels more than we do. Because he's a person. Little qualifier here, and this might come up again. Now, this is me. This isn't so much official Swedenborgian theology. I think people have a hard time keeping in their head the idea that God is infinite, you know, knows everything, can do everything, is everywhere, boundless, on the one hand. And on the other hand, God's like a guy, like a person, who cares about me. Because, you know, that's a person. You can picture them. They probably have hair. They walk around. But it's not the infiniteness. So you've got God as infinite on one side, and you've got God as someone who loves me on the other, and it's really hard to keep both in your head. It's kind of like walking along a fence. It's really tricky. Now, every now and then I meet people who tell me, they swear, oh no, I can do it fine. I don't believe them so much, but they swear they can do it. If, however, you have a hard time keeping both ideas in your head, my advice from Swedenborgian doctrine is just make sure you don't keep falling off the same side of the fence every time. If you're going to think of God as infinite, that's great. Remember to think of him as a person sometimes. If you find your thoughts more thinking that God's a dude, you know, it'd be great to hang out with, you know, with God. Remember that he's also infinite. And so long as both ideas are bouncing around inside your head, I think you're going to be on the right track. At least as a Swedenborgian.
So I know some Christian beliefs are really contradictory and like, God loves you unconditionally, but under some conditions, like some of these things that he says, like, does the new church believe that?
Well, contradictions are, I think contradictions are so much fun. So I can't claim that everybody sees no contradictions in Swedenborgian theology. But I can answer your specific question, and then I can give you sort of a principle on how to approach things that God says. In that particular example, loving unconditionally is a tricky thing to say. It doesn't mean you don't correct somebody. We can go back to the kid idea. If you're in a grocery store, right, which I'm sure you have all been in, and you're carting around like a 3-year-old, which maybe you have never done, but you can imagine it, right? And then that 3-year-old starts saying, I want a cookie, 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 I want a cookie. You can feel your blood pressure going up, and then you realize, if I just give him a cookie, he'll be quiet, right? Is that unconditional love? give him what he wants. Sounds maybe. Is it a good idea? No. Because if a little three-year-old says, I want a cookie 13 times, and then you give the kid a cookie, what has he learned? In order to get a cookie, he demands a cookie 13 times. And that actually will lead to his own unhappiness. So God does love us unconditionally. He's constantly pouring infinite love at us. That doesn't mean we get what we want. That doesn't mean that we have magical powers and wishes that get fulfilled. So to love somebody means you want them to be happy, right? Our three rules. Someone else, outside yourself, you have to want to be close to them, and you'll want to have to make them happy. That's what it is to love. So if we think of those as conditions, well, right there. Our unconditional love is over. But it is true that God wants for us as much happiness as we can possibly stand. That's what he wants for us. And a lot of the time, our answer to the Lord, our answer to God is, thank you, that amount of happiness sounds great, but I just want this tiny little bit of happiness instead. And his response is, okay. Now, the idea of he loves everybody, but a whole bunch of people go to hell, which is sort of a traditional idea out there. We don't think that God sends anyone to hell. That seems like a pretty mean thing to do. And there are lots of statements in the Old and New Testament that make it look like that. But the reality is that hell is just a place where evil people go to hang out. They don't have punishment, they don't have eternal hellfire, they weren't banished there in some formal sense. But in the other life, in the other world, you hang out with people who like the same things you do. So, do you like being helpful, or do you like not being helpful? Do you like telling the truth, or do you like telling lies? Do you gain your sense of satisfaction from making other people happy, or do you get your kicks making other people miserable? And that's how that works. And if someone insists on putting their happiness in, I get my happiness out of kicking other people in the teeth. Well, you can't let them around, you know, nice people. So what do you do with them? Well, now this is a little flippant, but all the people who like kicking each other's teeth in, they hang out together. And then, let's say there are 15 of them. Then every 15th time, you get to kick someone's teeth in. The other 14 out of 15 times, it's your turn. That's what hell is. And the Lord, God doesn't do that to anybody. He wants everybody to be as happy as they can possibly be that they choose. And the trick is to choose him. In the Old Testament, it says, before you stand life and death. Choose life. It's Moses. This is this great scene where he's up on a mountain and he's yelling at all the children of Israel about the things they got to do. So, a contradiction? No. Just like a parent can say you can't have a cookie from a place of great love to that three-year-old in the grocery cart, how does it feel to the three-year-old? Ah, you hate me. You don't like me at all. Because, you know, three-year-old thinks they want a cookie, that happiness comes from the cookie. And yet from a place of love, the parent says, no cookie. So that's not a contradiction. The idea of who gets sent to hell is a much bigger thing. We can go there if you'd like. But I'd like to introduce an idea that I call wrestling truths. And because it's not just, you know, religion and stuff like that, but all sorts of times in our life, we get ideas that we know both have to be real, but I don't see how they go together. A simple example would be, let's say you've got a friend who has, you know, some arterial wound and they're bleeding all over your car. Sorry to be so gruesome. And you have to get to the hospital and you're going along a road that's 35 miles an hour. That's the speed limit. How fast do you drive? Could I suggest that the law says 35 miles an hour and you'd better drive faster than that? How do you justify that? Both are true. The law is 35 miles an hour. Break the law. Well, it's a matter of priorities, right? Sorry, my friend has an arterial wound. Shh. I gotta get him there now. It trumps the law. Even if you end up getting a speeding ticket, you know which idea wins. Like they wrestle, speed limit, life of my friend. You know who wins. I'm gonna save my friend. All right, now this actually happened to me. When my third son was about to be born, he was a very, very impatient little guy. And so I'm driving to the hospital at 70 miles an hour. And I'm going on a road where the speed limit is 45. And that is very, very fast. And as I'm roaring down this road, I'm thinking, what am I going to do if the police pull in behind me and put their lights on and the siren? Because I'm not going to stop. Now, it didn't happen, but I realized that what I was going to do is I was just going to keep driving all the way to the hospital. And then I would deal with the police. The idea of which idea, you know, wins. And so this idea, well, you got to pick which idea wins, but you don't get rid of either of them. Because you still have that speed limit, right? So these have the idea of, well, which idea wins? So whenever you're trying to figure out how the Lord works, you know, how God works, just keep the big ideas winning. He's a God of love. So whatever else, you know that's true. So if you think, well, it says that God casts people to a burning lake of fire. There's one idea. But a bigger idea is that he's a God of love. And if you can't figure out how those ideas go together without fighting, then your job is to pick the winner. And can I suggest that the God of love be the winning idea in that case, rather than the God of pitching people into burning fires wins? So that's a basic approach on how we deal with truths that don't seem to agree. As well, which is the bigger truth? Which is the governing truth? When they wrestle, who wins? And we can do that in all sorts of things in life, but for theology, it's really important. So any contradiction, that's how you approach it.
How much does God actually, like, have to do with, like, the earth? Like, how involved is he in our lives?
Like, does he have his fingers in your mind kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah, well, there are a bunch of different positions on this. And when you read the book Divine Providence, which is a book of the heavenly doctrines on this, and it paints a wonderful, almost organic picture, but it's sort of frustrating in parts. You have sort of a sliding scale of beliefs. On the cold side, you have the belief that he's pretty much like a watchmaker. He designed the whole universe from the beginning and hit go, and now he's let go. And he doesn't do anything because it's all according to his plan. And he doesn't have to do anything because he wrote the rules. All right, there's sort of that side of things. And then you slide all the way over to the very, very warm side, cold and warm, cold and hot, the very hot side, and that is that every single moment God is constantly adjusting things, so that if you lose your wallet, it's where God put it. And if you're late to class, it's because God wanted you to be. God made you late for class. And if you have a fight with your friend, well, God wanted you to have a fight with your friend. See how these are sort of two extreme positions? Neither one is what the heavenly doctrines say. Now, I don't want to say they're in the middle, but that's how a lot of people conceive of it, where God attends to every tiny little thing in every single moment, which doesn't seem to leave a lot of room for us. But for example, think about your heart. Your heart is beating, presumably, right? You can nod. Yeah. How are you doing that? Are you focusing on that? Yeah, you are now. But people would say, well, it just does, right? Your heart just beats. Who's doing that? Well, we can follow the neurology through. Well, there are synapses in the brain that send messages to the heart, blah, 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 blah. But you chase it up the causal chain, the end cause and effect, what causes what. Eventually, you get to a statement like, well, it just does. And that's where God's fingers are. And the great thing about this is you can acknowledge it, but it doesn't mean you have to attribute to God your car accident or your fight with your friend. For example, no one ever seems to be worried about all of the matter of the universe flying apart. I can see on all of your faces, this is not one of your chief concerns this evening. Right? But all those electrons, right? All those protons. What if they didn't work right? Just for a bit. That would be really horrible. And you say, well, it's because that's not what the laws are. They just don't. They just don't. Gravity is my favorite example. Gravity. Anyone remember the rate or the power of gravity at the Earth's surface? See, I am a teacher, so I like to do this to people. 10 meters per second every second is the acceleration rate, basically, of gravity at the Earth's surface. But the more fundamental law of gravity is that gravity is a function of the difference between the center of two bodies and the square of the distance between those two bodies, right? Just nod your heads. Yeah. it's a law, right? The law of gravity. Says who? Everyone depends on it all the time. We don't even think about it, right? You could drop a bottle cap on the table. Same time, every time. We're used to those laws. We like those laws. Who's maintaining them? Do they need maintenance? We don't even think that they need maintenance. And yet that's where God's fingers are. And one last place we have to consider where God's fingers are, so to speak. I like the idea of fingers because it's a little creepy. Because, you know, the idea of, you know, of how does God participate in the universe? It's like, whoa, hey, who's messing with my world? Think about the thoughts that enter your head. Now, I apologize for the following thought experiment, but, and there's always someone who claims it doesn't work, but. You ever see a squirrel? I think of squirrels as sort of hostile. Imagine if a squirrel jumped off of that loft on its hind feet, and it had a miniature assault rifle, and it came at you. Preposterous, right? And yet you are now thinking of a squirrel holding a miniature assault rifle. I made you think things. Where'd that thought come from? Where did it come from? Did it come from me? I mean, in one creepy sense, yes, I planted it there. But what about your ability to think? Where do all your other thoughts come from? Do they come from you? They just bubble up from all the fat that your brain's made out of? Your thoughts have to come from somewhere. They don't come from you. It can be a little odd thinking about this, but you're just a vessel for life. Life doesn't come from you. What about your ability to want things? Like, what if you like cookies and cream ice cream? Yeah, it's great. Why? You can play the annoying sixth grade game. Why? You know, sixth graders do this. Sometimes high schoolers do this. Your ability to want doesn't come from you. Your ability to think doesn't come from you. It comes from God. And not in a sense that he's flipped the switch way back at the beginning of creation. He's constantly doing it. He's constantly pouring more in to make sure you can think and feel. In that sense, you're like wires. Wires don't make electricity. Right? And yet we think of them as having electricity. That's why you don't touch, you know, live wires in your wall when you're doing rewiring. Oh, there's electricity in them. But no one thinks that the wires, you know, made the electricity. Same goes for all your thoughts, all your affections, all your feelings. You didn't make them. Who did? And so that's where it gets a little creepy. Wait, is he making me think things? Am I angry at my friend because God made me angry? Nah, first of all, it's not nearly so clumsy. Second of all, remember, your freedom is his most important thing. And third of all, just because he's giving you thoughts doesn't mean they come out the way he sent them. For example, I don't think that God wanted you to think of a squirrel with a miniature assault rifle. I messed with your heads to make you think that. But the ability to think ultimately does come from God. So how does he have an effect on the universe? He constantly maintains his laws of physics and all those fundamental things. But of course, they're a constant. He constantly is rearranging the tiniest little things that we see, but we don't see it. And he is constantly allowing us to have the ability to think, to want, and to do. That's a lot of effect in life. And where I draw the line is, in terms of responsibility, if I were to, take this microphone and bonk one of you on the head, I couldn't blame God for that, right? Everyone would see that? Because who did that? I did that. But I did it with all the power that God had given me, right? Because I can want to bonk you with a microphone, I can plan to bonk you with a microphone, and then I can take it and whack. God's not responsible for that. I'm responsible for what I do with what God gives me. So how much effect does God have in the world? All of it, but you can't see it. And so you are in perfect freedom. You can hear how there's like currents underneath that. That we could get into if you wanted, but there's my answer to start with.
You were talking about how, you know, like 14 out of 15 times in, like, for the person in hell, like his teeth would be like kicked in or something like that.
We're talking about an image of hell.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. What happens, like eventually he's going to get sick and tired of having his teeth bashed in. Would God, like, prepare him to be around good people in heaven? Or
well,
is he stuck there forever?
stuck there forever. The basic question is hell forever? Now, that's huge. But let's talk about getting your teeth kicked in. Because, you know, hey, that's lots of fun. We would certainly learn, right? Like, you ever have a friend who's just always getting you into trouble? And it's fun at first, but then, you know, when it's 4:30 in the morning and you've been brought home by the police, you realize it wasn't fun. Hopefully, maybe not that extreme. And eventually you learn, when I hang out with this friend, it just goes badly. And we can learn to, and avoid him, right? Or we can say, hey, listen, Steven, I just can't hang out with you anymore. It always goes bad. We can reflect on our experiences and we can make new choices. So can people in heaven, so can people in hell. But there's a difference on earth. And I'll see if I can hit all the pieces without totally going off track. We live in a world where the world around you does not reflect how you think and feel, right? Like, you can be having a horrible day, and it can be bright and sunny with little bunnies out on the field and birds chirping, and you're just miserable inside. The outside doesn't match the inside at all. You can also hang out with people who want totally different things than you, right? You can sit in a class, and there's one kid who doesn't want to be there at all. There's one kid who only wants to be there because of who they're sitting next to. And there's one kid, theoretically, who actually wants to learn what the teacher's saying. Right? They're all in the same room, even though they're in totally different places, mentally. That's what makes the other world different. They wouldn't be in the same place in the other world. In the other world, you're around what you love. You see what you think. So to get back to the doing bad stuff, we can eventually say, I'm sick of having my teeth kicked in, I'm going to go do something else. Let's say that person then goes to try and be nice. All right, they're gonna go around and see who needs help getting their car out of the ditch on a hot road or something. Are they going to want to do that? Is that going to be fun? Probably not. We can do things that we don't like doing. Understand how weird that is? You can do things that you don't like doing. And we can get all tangled in our words. Well, I didn't want to do it, but I did it. Which meant that I wanted to do it, even though I didn't want to do it. Wait, what? Basic idea is we can do things that we do not enjoy. This is an amazing power. Because by doing things, you make it real in your life. Like, if you're a really greedy person, and you say, oh, I gotta stop being so greedy. So you walk around with quarters in your pocket. And whenever you see someone under the age of 12, you say, hey, do you want a quarter? You give them a quarter. Through gritted teeth, oh, but it's my money! So somebody does that, right? Or let's say somebody comes to school every day with an extra lunch, and they love food. And they love eating two lunches. And every day they bring an extra lunch, and it's public knowledge, right? And so whoever did not bring a lunch that day knows they can go to this guy, and he always brings an extra lunch. And he just waits. I hope no one needs a lunch. Please, no one need a lunch so that I can eat two lunches. Oh, no. Here they come. I can see they don't have any lunch. I gotta give them my lunch. Here you go. And he slides his extra lunch across the table. Is that a generous person? Oh, he hates doing it. Ugh. Slides it across the table. Are they a generous person? Hey, he gives people lunches. Doesn't enjoy doing it. But he does it anyway. That's something we can do. So you can be a generous person. Doesn't matter how you feel or whether you enjoy it. And the thing is, if you do good things like that, like being generous and honest and kind and all those other good things, that makes it real in your life. That is who you are then. That becomes you. That's how you get to be a good person. You think, oh, doing bad stuff is so much fun, but I'm going to stop doing it. And that's how you change. I'd rather do something bad, but I'm not going to. The basic idea of repentance. Instead, I'm going to do good stuff. And that actually changes who you are. Now, the thing about hell is, by the time you find your eternal resting place, you know, in heaven or hell, or however you want to describe it, you've cleared out of yourself everything that doesn't agree with your most important love. In Swedenborgian theology, we have this idea of a ruling love, a dominant love, that thing that you would never give up. You'd give up everything else before that. Like, let's say, mostly I have to be right. Let's pick a bad example. I'm willing to give up everything else so long as I'm right. Have you ever seen what this looks like, just, you know, in an argument or in a friendship? The kind of person who always needs the last word, or can't help correcting other people, or just, but I'm right, you know? And they'll sacrifice friendships, they'll sacrifice peace, they'll sacrifice their grade, everything, to be right. That's an image of hell. That's horrible. But when you die and you go to the other world, it's like a giant resolution. You've got to figure out what is that thing that you are at your core. And everything else has to go. It either has to get along with it and become sort of a subservient part of that love, or it's got to go. So these evil people, who, you know, the teeth-kicking people, they don't have anything left in them that likes being nice to the neighbor. If they did, it could have saved them beforehand. But it would be so horrible to go through life liking the neighbor and liking kicking the neighbor's teeth in. Because then you'd feel so bad kicking their teeth in. Right? So in the Lord's mercy, he takes that away from them. So they just enjoy what they enjoy. But that means they can't change. So Swedenborgian theology insists that hell is eternal. And I know a lot of people who don't like that idea. In fact, I'm one of them. I don't like that idea. I totally believe it.
So, what is the relationship between God and heaven and hell? And is he constantly at war with evil spirits?
That's a great question. Is God constantly at war with evil spirits? First of all, if God is constantly at war with evil spirits, you think that war would be over? Because, I mean, infinite being, who's going to stand up to him? But there's definitely a conflict, right? When we feel that conflict, we can feel it in ourselves. Ugh! The $5 is just sitting there on his dresser, and I need $5. I mean, if you can feel it inside yourself as a combat, don't steal, $5. So there's definitely some sort of a combat, and you got to figure the Lord's on the good side, so who's on the bad side? Well, hell. So there is a conflict. But here's the tricky thing to the conflict, though. The hells, and as I like to say, someone down there hates you. They're real, and they are, you know, they are an influence of evil in your life. And they want you to join them. So they want you to engage in every evil desire you've got. And they are constantly influencing you, trying to get you to do this stuff. We can go into how they do that. And they have no interest in you being free, right? They just want you to be evil. On the other side, you've got the Lord and, you know, like the angels. What do they want? Well, they want you... You know, they want you to be good. They want you to get your happiness from doing good stuff. But that's not what they want most of all. I know it sounds weird, but that's not what the Lord wants most of all. What he wants most of all is you to have freedom. Because if you don't have freedom, if he's making you choose good, then it's not real. You're not even a person then. So you can think of it this way. You can have some scales, like some old-style scales with two bowls, right? And you pour things into each of the bowls, and you can see how it balances as the two bowls go up and down. Well, the hells are leaning on their side of the scales as much as they possibly can. In your life, and, you know, in the cosmic, you know, sense of it. And they're leaning as hard as they can on that side of the scales. And the Lord and all his angels are just holding their side of the scales. They're not leaning hard. They don't need to. They're just keeping them equal. Keeping them in equilibrium. So that the influences in your life are equally evil and good. So that the vectors cancel out. I don't know if you've studied vectors. But, you know, if you get all the vectors and they cancel out, it's like there's no influence at all on the subject body. So, like, if you take a person and one person is shoving on their shoulder one way and someone is shoving on their shoulder equally the other way, then they'd pick where to move. The vectors cancel out. And that's what the angels and the Lord do in our life. They cancel out the vectors, so we have freedom. But the person who's being shoved on by two people, that doesn't mean it's peaceful. They're being pushed in multiple directions. They just happen to all cancel out. So when you're looking at someone's $5 bill on their dresser, but I need me some money! It's the hells leaning as hard as they can on their side of the scales, and the Lord and his angels, not that he needs the help, but that's how he operates, holding their side of the scales even. To keep you in equilibrium. It's not peaceful, but it is free. and there are lots of ways this plays out. So there is a war, in that sense, between the Lord and Hell. But Hell's trying to win. The Lord's trying to preserve your freedom. And that's why it doesn't end.
Does Lord care about specific people?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a great phrase. Oh, I love all people except for any person in particular. Or, I love humanity, it's the people I can't stand. Or funny phrases like that. Now, there's this great idea in the Heavenly Doctrines, and, it's all this stuff about general ideas and specific ideas, etc. But what we care about here is, general things aren't real unless they really affect the specific things. Right? The example the Heavenly Doctrines give is a king. If a king ever just gave general edicts, everybody should eat dinner, or everybody should pay $5 in taxes, or whatever, just gave general edicts, and it never, ever actually got to a specific person, you know, it got lost in the bureaucracy or something like that, then that king isn't king. He's not really in charge. General ideas, unless they get down to specifics, they don't really have any effect. So the Lord specifically loves you. You. All those memories you have, yep, he was there with you. He understands them better than you do. He has a specific plan for you. Not that you'll ever know. He is happy when you're happy, and he is less happy when you're sad. You specifically. It's really important for us to keep that idea. Otherwise, he seems like sort of this distant, you know, guy with a beard who just keeps the store running, doesn't seem to care about you. And that's not the case at all. He cares rather specifically for you. In the New Testament, it says, birds. You can buy a bird for like 3 coins, right? Lord knows exactly how many birds there are. And he cares about every single bird. You can buy them for 2 coins. 2 coins, 3 coins. And how much more important are you than a bunch of birds? Way more important. He knows you so well, he has numbered every single hair on your head. That's how well he knows you. Oh, hair number 87,423 just came out. That's how specifically he knows you. Some people find that a little unnerving. Oh well, he knows you that well.
Are humans the only things that were made in God's image and likeness?
Are humans the only thing in God's image and likeness? Yes or no questions are tricky. I would say they're the only ones in his image enough to love him back. Now, we'll go a little philosophic for a second. If you had like a rock or like a cinder block, right? This room has cinder blocks in it. That cinder block doesn't exist because it exists. Its existence is dependent upon God. I mean, in one sense, you could say, well, the cinder block exists because God wants it to exist. And how do we know that? Well, because we live in a universe of matter, and someone was able to make the cinder block, and the cinder block still sticks around because God lets it. They're his rules of physics, all this kind of stuff. And everything in the universe is an expression of this fact that God is, and so everything else is too. And so if you think of God as good and truth, of wanting and thinking, there's this massive equation called the conjugal principle. That good and truth make everything in the world. And you see this in the physical world through the idea of substance and form. Now, we'll come out of the philosophic clouds in a moment, but this is sort of important as background. So anything that exists, you know, some scissors, your left boot, whatever it is, it exists in that it's got substance, right? There's stuffness to it. And it's got form, right? You can describe it. You know, it's this big, it's this color, it's... It smells like this, whatever, you know, whatever object it is. And everything in the universe has to have these two qualities. Stuffness and adjectives, you could call it. So in that sense, a cinder block or your left boot is an image of God. Right? Because it's got stuffness and it's got form. But it's not as much an image of God as you are. And so all of creation is sort of in a hierarchy in terms of how alike God it is. You know, rocks being pretty low, I don't know, beetles and bugs, you know, not being very high. You can imagine dogs. People love dogs. Dogs being higher than beetles, let's say, I don't know. But then you get to people, and people are different. Now, Dog lovers may not like this, but dogs can't actually love you. Can a dog decide not to love you? Can a dog reflect and say, you know what, I'm just not having a good day today? They can appear to, and they're very loyal. But a dog actually can't decide to love you. A dog can't respect rights. A dog can't do the right thing. Right? It can be loyal, and it can respond to stimuli and bribes and punishments and rewards and all that kind of stuff. But only people can think about what the right thing to do is. Only people can be honest. Only people can respond to God's love by loving him back. And conversely, only people can decide to not love him. Again, think of a god. A dog. Can a dog decide not to love God? Leaving aside the question of how we'd ever know, it's just not part of how a dog works. They don't have that part. But we've been given the ability to say, whoa, but I'm going to be my own person. Even though, how do we pull that off, right? But the Lord has given us the power to say, hey, you can love me or not. You get to decide who you are. And that makes people unique in all of creation. It has lots of effects. For example, we can do things that we don't want to do. We can think thoughts that we don't like. Animals can't do that. Animals can remember, but reflect? That's different. Even a dog who's got like the treat on their nose and they're being told, stay. You know, we've seen the films where the dog's like, you know, all tense for the treat on his nose because it wants that treat. And how does he know he gets the treat? Because the owner's voice tells him when to get the treat. The dog's not thinking it's the wrong thing to do to take the treat. We can do that. And we can decide some days, I'm just going to take the treat. We can decide to be evil. We can decide to be noble. We can decide to be cowardly. Animals can't do that. And the reason we can do all this is because we are so close to his image that we get to have freedom. We get to make ourselves who we are. Are you going to have at your core, I love helping people? Are you going to have at your core, I do what's right? Are you going to have at your core, I just want it to be peaceful and orderly? Because you can do that. Nothing else in creation can do that. But of course, it comes with that obverse idea that you can make your core, I'm the only thing that matters. Which is a pretty hellish idea. So the basic answer is, everything in some sense is in the image and likeness of God. But we're the only thing enough in his image and likeness where we can love him back. That's why we have an afterlife. And dogs don't. I'm sorry if this is bad news for anybody. Cats, obviously, by the way, don't have an afterlife because all cats are evil. Everybody knows that.
Now, is there, like, a physical presence of God? Like, is there a guy up there in the clouds sitting on a throne, or is that more of, like, a state of mind?
Guy in a cloud or state of mind? If I had to pick between guy in a cloud and state of mind, I'm going to go with state of mind. Little sidebar. Swedenborgian theology is often about the prepositions. Now, I'm sorry to go grammatical on you, but the difference between him governing through heaven versus him governing from heaven is a huge difference. And I'll spare you all the little details, but... Well, think of it this way. How far away is God? Is he 2 feet away? 80,000 feet away? Because once you try to imagine distance between you and God, you know that's silly, right? He's got to be, you know, right here, right between your ears. He's as close to you as you are. But that's pretty unnerving. So he allows for an appearance of distance, a gap between you and him. Whoa, God may want this, but maybe I don't, right? That allows for a gap. And we in our brain can translate that as a geographic distance. And the Lord's answer to that is, well, okay, if you want to think of it that way. So it's the idea of an appearance. So state of mind is definitely the better way to go. You can be an angel. You can be in heaven before you die. This is an important idea in Swedenborgian theology. Anytime you derive your happiness from loving the neighbor, loving what's right, loving God, that's heavenly. You don't need to die for that. And anytime you think happiness comes from getting what you want, and to hell with everybody else is hell. And you don't have to die for that either. So your spiritual state, that's the phrase we use, your spiritual state is a state of mind. And that's a better way of thinking about, oh, all sorts of things. So is God a guy on a cloud? No. Maybe in some sense it's useful for some people to think of them as a guy far off. But no, he's right there with you. But remember, let's go back to our basics. God is one. God's a person. So if you can't think of him as a person unless you think of him as somebody out there, then you better think of him as somebody out there. Now, whether he's physical or not, that gets to be a more complicated glorification question.
Did God create the world, or did the world evolve through the process of evolution?
Yes. Yeah, evolution or God. Who you got, right? Well, Swedenborgians have one of these you're both right kind of answers that I find so irritating sometimes. Now, a lot of things rolled up into this. First of all, do you believe that God is irrational or not? Second of all, how do you take, you know, the account in Genesis about the days of creation? And third of all, we already touched on this a little bit, how do you see God operating in the universe? So a lot of stuff gets rolled into the evolution thing. If you're Swedenborgian, you don't have to believe in evolution. I'm Swedenborgian. I think evolution's the most solid explanation I've heard yet for how the universe came to be. It's got some holes in it. That's the fun part. So, do you think God is irrational? Or is he orderly? Because some people think he's irrational. Like, the reason it's raining today is because God wants it to. Is that ever why it rains? Well, now you could play a pedantic game and say, well, because of the laws of physics, blah, blah, blah. No. The reason it rains today is because of the laws of precipitation and, you know, air density and meteorological conditions and gravity and all those laws that we already know about. Because the Lord has created an orderly universe. It may not look that way all the time, but it is completely orderly. It is governed by laws. So, which sounds like a more orderly way to go? Day one, bing. Day two, bing. Day three, bing. Or things evolve over time. Single-celled animals like those little hydras and the paramecia and things like that. And then you get fish, and then eventually, you know, you get, you know, insurance salesmen, right? They're people. That process sounds like an orderly process. So I say, yeah, that sounds like the way God works. That's the way my God works. An orderly process governed by laws. Now, I'm not saying the heavenly doctrines say that evolution happened. Heavenly doctrines say that God works in an orderly fashion. He is order itself. There's nothing capricious about the guy. Then the question becomes, well, what about in Genesis? You know, day one, it's light and dark. Day two, waters get divided. Day three, we got dry land. Day four, the sun shows up. That's always where I got really confused. Like, the sun on day four, really. Because those first 3 days must have been really crazy. And this is one of the big dividing points between Swedenborgianism or Swedenborgian theology and a lot of other Christianities, but not all of them. We think that the Old and New Testament is God speaking to us. Everyone's on board that. We, however, think that the face meaning of the text is not always the most important thing God's telling us. For example, God says, let's see a good example. Oh, at one point, he's telling the children of Israel that when you get to the land, at some point you have to slaughter all of the Amalekites. The Amalekites are this other desert people. Man, woman, and child. Kill them all! Do we still have to do that? Because I don't see anybody, you know, putting together a fund to kill all the Amalekites. But why would God say that? He must have had some inner meaning he was trying to tell us. Or think about the parable of the sower, right? You guys know the parable of the sower. There's a guy with a bunch of seeds. He throws seed and some of it ends up on the path and the birds eat it. He throws seed and it ends up on the hard-packed earth. And it sprouts, but then it dies because the sun's real hot. And then he throws some seeds out into the weeds. And they grow up, but the weeds grow up with them, and the weeds win and choke out the good stuff. And then some of the seeds get thrown on the nice earth, and they grow up, and they become grain. Yay! Everybody knows that's got an inner meaning, right? The Lord's not saying, now everybody go get some grass seed, and that's what we do. So we all already believe that the Bible, the Old and New Testament, have an inner meaning. But we take it maybe one step farther by saying every single thing in the Old New Testament has an inner meaning. Now, sometimes the meaning shines right through to the front of the face, so to speak. For example, Exodus 20. Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't commit adultery, right? You know these ones? I don't think we need to spend a lot of time scratching our chin thinking, what does he mean by that? I think he's pretty clear what he means by that, right? Don't steal! But that doesn't mean there's not more to that. It doesn't mean there's a deeper meaning to don't steal. Right? Or don't murder. Let's take murder. Although in Hebrew, I'll spare you the details, the word is kill, and they knew that included murder. We can do Hebrew for a while. Hebrew's awesome, crazy fun. But anyway, so he says don't kill. We know that means, you know, don't kill. Don't take knives to your friends. But what if you go behind your friend's back and say, do you know what Stephen said? Stephen actually hates your guts. And you go to someone else, you know, Stephen actually hates your guts. And you go to a third person, you know, Stephen actually hates your guts. You know what I heard him say? What have you done to Stephen?
Killed his reputation.
Yeah, you've killed his reputation. Oh, but there was no knife. No, hring, 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 you know, stabbing. I didn't break that commandment. Oh, you totally did. You harbored anger, maybe hatred in your heart, and you tried to hurt Stephen by saying vicious things about him. That's covered in that commandment. So we go one step further and say everything in the Old and New Testament has an inner, deeper meaning. And the Lord wants to tell us those things too. Now, we've wandered a little far afield from the evolution question, so let's come all the way back to Genesis chapters 1 and 2. So when these 7 days are described, what's the inner meaning? Now, first, I'll spare you the fact that in ancient cultures, writing down literal facts was pointless because the literacy rate was like 2%. So think of it more as like a secret code among like government operatives than as signposts out on a street, because very few people could read. But the 7 days of creation are not a description necessarily of the chronology of our physical universe, because why would we care about that? I know it's fun, but you'd think he'd begin his book with something a little more important. So the 7 days of creation are the basic blueprint of how you go to heaven. And everything that follows those 7 days of creations are a collection of, well, but what ifs, and conditional situations, and descriptions of how things go wrong. But those first 7 days are, this is how life works. But you wouldn't know it from the face. So then the big question becomes, well, if it's not about the historical creation of the universe, and I, you know, Mr. Reverend Scott Dennis Frazier, are claiming it's the basic rules of how you be happy, how you get to heaven, where'd you get that? Because I didn't make it up. And the answer is Emanuel Swedenborg. Now, this gets back to why we get called Swedenborgians. We believe that there have been prophets. Everybody, all Christians believe this. They've got names like Jeremiah and Luke and Moses. We add to that list a guy by the name of Emanuel Swedenborg. And so I always get a little amused by people who say, oh, yes, I believe in prophets, but not that one. Well, no, wait, why not that one? You believe your guys, I believe my guys. And part of the prophecies, if you will, of the revelation given to Emanuel Swedenborg is, what are these inner meanings? So he goes through specific detail in a book called Arcana Celestia, what the book of Genesis means, verse by verse, in exhaustive detail. And I believe, as a Swedenborgian, that he was led to do this by God. So, like, you and I, we can argue about what the parable of the sower means, or what the kill all the Amalekites thing's all about, or even the 7 days of creation. And we would be guessing. But when you crack open Arcana Celestia, I don't think we're guessing anymore. That's the answer. We actually have a model of this in Jesus Christ. At one point, I think it's in Matthew, he's going through all these Old Testament commandments. He's like, all right, now, remember the law that said, if you want to divorce a woman, all you got to do is write on a piece of paper, we're divorced, and you hand it to her? Yeah, that's not the way it's supposed to be. That is exactly what the Old Testament says, by the way. That's not the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to stay married forever. You leave your family, you stick to your wife, and you don't ever leave. That's what it's supposed to be. So he's telling them in the New Testament what some of those Old Testament laws really mean. Yeah, I know the original law said don't commit adultery. That's still true. But I tell you that if you look at another man's wife with lust, that's also adultery. See, he's giving an inner meaning. Emanuel Swedenborg, from the Lord, goes into great detail about these things. So just a quick thing on the 7 days of creation. I don't think it's a model of the Big Bang or anything like that. I think it's the basic rules of happiness. And the first rule of happiness is there's a difference between light and dark. Right? Oh! How about there's a difference? The most basic mental function. A and B are different. If you don't have that, you're not getting anywhere. Second day. Waters above, waters beneath. Oh, information is different. Right? Like, how you tie your shoe is different than the GDP of the United States. Information is different, and some information matters more than others. Day three. Oh, I can do things. And so there's an inner meaning to all these days. They tell us how to be happy. So that's a very, very long answer that says the Lord created the world through evolution, as far as I can tell.
So we hear in the word, like, the Lord working all these miracles and, like, you know, like, multiplying bread and fish to serve a whole bunch of people and stuff. Do you think the Lord's still working miracles in our lives today?
Well, that's a good one. Yeah, there's a guy by the name of Edward Gibbon who wrote this colossally long book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It runs, like, 3,300 pages in paperback. And one of the things he says there is, okay, if you believe in miracles, then you have one of two positions. First of all, okay, if you don't believe in miracles, then there have never been miracles. Easy position. If you believe in miracles, you either believe that they still happen today, or there's a moment in time where they stopped. Where's that moment? Right? Because if we're not seeing water turn to wine now, when did that stop? You know? And I don't have a solid answer for you in terms of what the writings say, but I've got some ideas that can maybe wrestle together. Number one, as we've already discussed, the Lord is a God of order. He's got an orderly universe. He maintains all these laws of physics and all the other laws that we see. And so in that sense, we don't expect miracles to happen just chaotically. He's not a capricious God. It's not like we're going to go into our pantry one day and see 4 loaves of bread, and then go into our pantry the next day and see 84 loaves of bread. Oh, wow, it's a miracle. That's not the universe we live in as a sort of a default setting. We expect the laws as we understand them to be followed, and if they're not being followed, there must be some other stronger law that's in place. So in that sense, we don't live in a world of miracles every day, because that would be chaotic and unnerving and undependable. So there's that first thing. He's a God of order, so that's our default setting. However, we do know that there were miracles, because, you know, he did turn the water to wine. We've got the idea of Joshua getting a longer day. We've got the idea of Swedenborg being given the revelation as to the inner meaning of the Bible and the ability to speak to people of both heaven and hell. So that's a miracle. So in that sense, number two, we don't know for sure that they stopped. Now, maybe I'm missing a statement somewhere, but I could allow for the possibility that it continues. But then number three is, what is the use of miracles? Because divine providence makes it clear that we don't come to a place of faith from miracles. It might seem like we do, but that's actually not a very good reason to believe something. Oh, because I saw a sign. I mean, if you think about it, who decides what a sign means? For example, what if you see 3 red birds out on a tree? Oh, that means that I should be a plumber. who's to decide? No, really, there are people who live their lives this way. For example, in, you know, who they should marry, not that they're looking at birds on a tree, but they say, oh, I found the same book that they read. This must be a sign. I'm supposed to be with them. No, that's not the way the world works. So the third idea is that we are supposed to live our lives by the human reason we've been given, not from miracles. The purpose of miracles is to serve as a symbol of the Lord's power. We already have an Old and New Testament full of these symbols of power. So we don't, in that sense, need any more miracles. So I guess that's a longer answer, but could there be more miracles? Sure. Are there? I haven't seen any. Would there be? What use would it serve? Because the use served by previous miracles is still being served by those very miracles.
So, how much, like, if God knows everything, how close are we able to get to knowing as much as Him? And what limits us? Is it Him limiting us, or is it us limiting ourselves?
Oh, that's a good one. One of the, you could say, mottos of the Swedenborgian Church or Swedenborgian theology is, in Latin, it's Nunc liceat intellectualiter intrare arcana fidei, which means now it is permitted to enter into the mysteries of faith with understanding. And a big part of Swedenborgian theology is that these things are understandable and you can learn them. God is not a mysterious, capricious God and you just gotta believe. No, you can only believe those things that make sense to you that you can add to your behavior. If it doesn't make sense to you, you can't do it. I mean, I guess you could do it blindly. But faith is inner sight. Faith is getting how something works. Getting how life works and doing it. So we're really big in understanding things. Now, in terms of your limits, what can you understand? When are you full? When does God say, whoop, that's enough? The answer is never. A fun idea from the Heavenly Doctrines is that whenever you think of time, it's just a symbol of wisdom. Incidentally, whenever you think of space, like geography and distance and stuff, you should think of love. And our language actually reflects this. Are you near to that person, or are you guys worlds apart? Is that a statement of geography or what you care about? Our language already plays with that connection. Well, states of time are states of wisdom. And, you know, movies aside, time only moves in one direction, forward, and it's never going to end. And that's because wisdom only moves in one direction, and it's never going to end. It only goes more and more and more. Now, some of you have not had the experience of forgetting high school chemistry. Even though we think we forget things, like high school chemistry, it's an illusion. You actually don't forget anything. You never backwards learn. You don't ever get dumber. You only learn more and more. You never lose what you learn. So in that sense, we only increase in wisdom. Forever. So how can we never get to be God? What holds us back? Who's putting on the brakes? If you think about the mathematical idea of convergence and divergence, I'll try and be quick with this, because I know it's totally not fair to go into like calculus and trigonometry when you're asking religion questions. So, briefly, you can have an equation where the function converges to some number, like think of a graph of a curve and it levels out to like 7. That's one way to think of the universe. Or you could have a curve that kind of goes up, like a big ramp. And you could say, well, it's never going to stop, but does it ever get to infinity? No, it never gets to infinity. And that's the way our wisdom and our knowledge works. It is only going to increase forever. But that doesn't mean it's ever going to get to where God is. There's no limit on it, but there's not enough finite wisdom to get to infinite wisdom. They just don't connect that way. Then you get the idea of what's holding us back? Well, the Lord is not holding us back. He's constantly pouring in as much divine wisdom as we can handle. So how much can we handle? Well, if you think of Psalm 23, one of the lines from Psalm 23, you know, that's, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. My cup runneth over. And when you think of your cup running over, please don't think of it as like having a mug and you've got it under the sink and it's like, and it's kind of dribbling over the side. That's not a good model for how the Lord is pouring things into you. Imagine you're holding your little mug into Niagara Falls. Now, technically speaking, your cup is running over. How much water are you getting? A full cup. How much are you losing? Enormous amounts. But that's all right. You've got a full cup. That's a little bit of an image of the difference between infinite knowledge and the kind of wisdom we can have after 10 million years. So what's holding us back? We're holding ourselves back. I'm not saying that we can be God, but we're mortal. We're human. We got to do things in order. So we add and add and add. And furthermore, we are much more inclined to grab knowledge and work with knowledge and add to the kind of knowledge that is attached to something we love. Now, people who have been in institutionalized education are intimately familiar with this dynamic. You're in a class where the teacher talks like this and mostly is trying to kill you with icicles of boredom. Right? We've all had those situations. And whatever they're saying, you can practically feel it dribbling out your ears as they say it, right? It doesn't stick. Heavenly doctrines compare this to a feather on a wall. And what happens? And it's gone, right? It looks like we've forgotten it. But if you have a really good friend and they say, oh my goodness, you should hear about the weekend I had, you're going to pay attention because you care. So we always care more about information. I mean, we always remember information we care about more than we remember information we don't care about. Anyone who is an expert, say, in Elder Scrolls versus chemistry can tell you this. Someone who cares about a video game, they know everything about that video game. It doesn't mean they're going to pass their science test because they don't care. So in that sense, what's holding us back is our sense of caring. So let me leave you with this. A challenging question. What are you interested in? Is there anything that's actually boring? Because to God, nothing is boring. Because he understands it. Everything is fascinating and important. But we're not God. So when something is boring, what made it boring? Is it because there's just some information not worth knowing? That can't be true. Someone's presenting it in a way where it's not very exciting. You know, it's not snappy and you know, zippy with lots of bells and whistles. Well, but if someone says to you in a very boring face, you just won the lottery, that's not boring information. So what makes something boring? Something is boring if we don't see how it leads to happiness. If we don't see how it leads to happiness. If someone says, I got $1 million, do you want it? We think we see exactly how that leads to happiness, right? We could be wrong, but we think we've got it. I know why that matters. If someone says, if you know the truth will set you free. And that doesn't mean anything to you. Boring. What's going on is that you don't get how it leads to happiness. That's where boredom really comes from. So, for example, teachers are always trying to make things interesting. Bad teachers try and make it interesting by jumping around and shouting at you, or by showing videos, right? We've all seen that. The better way to do it is by demonstrating how it leads to happiness. Not momentary happiness that comes from eating an Arby's roast beef sandwich, and I love Arby's, but like real happiness. And the reason that's true is because what actually limits what we know is what we care about. You should care about a lot of stuff. And that's an application of this universal principle. We've already mentioned it once. It's called the conjugal principle. It's a weird word. And it means that everything in the universe is a combination of good and truth. Wanting and thinking. Substance and form. Love and wisdom. Lots and lots of these pairs. And so if you know something, it's because you want it. And if you don't see that connection, then nothing's there.